Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. We are back, for better or worse, with one of our most perennial subjects on Keynote, the Holocaust. Sometimes I think all these books about the Holocaust are simply mirrors for how we feel these days. We did a show with Judy Battalion, a best-selling writer, on the Holocaust as a story of female defiance, which may reflect the 2020s more than the 1940s. We've done them with comedians like the American Jerry Stahl on his long, strange, and rather funny and sad trip visiting Nazi concentration camps. But most of the shows we've done about the Holocaust are about remembering. We did one with Linda Kintzler, who's written a magnificent book on remembering the Holocaust. And then, of course, another way of thinking about remembering is never forgetting. We did one with Wojciech Szczurzwiska, who I'm mispronouncing, who runs the Birkenau Auschwitz Museum. And then many writers seem ambivalent about writing about the Holocaust. We had Lauren Grodstein on the show, has a very good new novel out, We Must Not Think of Ourselves, who told me that she was determined not to write a novel about the Holocaust until, of course, she did. And that seems to be true of all sorts of creatives, journalists, writers. And we indeed have another book on the Holocaust, Final Verdict, The Holocaust on Trial in the 21st Century by my guest today, Tobias Buck. He's the managing editor of the Financial Times. He clearly drew the short straw on that one. Tobias, why do we need another book? I'm sure you've asked yourself this many times, both in researching, writing, and perhaps even now with the publication. Why do we need another book on the Holocaust?
Well, you're certainly right that there's no shortage of books and no shortage of new aspects that that writers find interesting and captivating about the Holocaust. I mean, the reason why I ended up writing a book, because I did think that this particular aspect of the Holocaust had not been told anywhere, really, which is the story of these last Holocaust criminal trials that took place in Germany since 2011. And I thought this really was a very interesting and moving and, to me, captivating story. So I decided to turn what was initially a feature magazine piece for the Financial Times Weekend magazine into a book.
Your book is very personal. It's not just a book about the Holocaust and the Holocaust trial that you note. It's also a book about yourself and your Germanness. Tell me about yourself and your family.
Well, so I am half British, half German, but grew up in Germany and obviously had a set of German grandparents. And one of the things that struck me about following this trial in Hamburg of this 93-year-old concentration camp guard was that I sort of asked myself, well, could that have been my grandfather in the dock? He was much older than the accused in this trial, but it did make me think, and it did make me think back to my own childhood visits of my grandparents' home and the wedding photo that was on display there, which showed my grandfather in a Nazi uniform with a swastika armband. And it was just interesting to me to reflect on the fact that this was never really discussed, that I never bothered to ask any questions around why that photo came into being, why it was still on display, and so forth. And so as I started writing this book, I thought I should try and investigate this aspect of my own family's history a little bit more closely. And it indeed emerged that my grandfather was a member of the Nazi Party. He was briefly a member of the SS, albeit long before the Holocaust took place. But it just served to me, and hopefully also to readers, as a reminder of just how common this kind of thing is in all Germans' families. Show me a German and you will, you know, I can show you a story of, you know, not dissimilar from the one of my grandfather, and perhaps not so dissimilar from the one that is told in this book of Born or Die and his time at Stutthof concentration camp.
So the book is about Bruno Dye. I mean, that's the sort of the architecture of the narrative of Final Verdict is about the trial of Bruno Dye, who I think you covered this for the FT, right? Back it was in Hamburg. You covered it back in 2020. In terms of digging up your own past, did Bruno Dye remind you of your father? Could not your father, sorry, your grandfather, but for the grace of God, could that have been your grandfather in your view?
I mean, no two stories are quite the same. I mean, my grandfather was much older. He, to the best of my knowledge, never, though he was employed by the Nazi state in the so-called Reich Labor Service, to the best of my knowledge, he was not involved in any of the terrible crimes committed under the Nazi regime at the time, although he did serve as a soldier in the final years. But I do think that one of the things that I was very interested in telling this story was the contribution that the sort of little people make to great historical crimes and the responsibility that is attached to that. And I think in that sense, if you, I mean, one of the lessons I took away from this trial and from this story was that the responsibility and the culpability, and indeed also the criminal culpability for the Holocaust, stretches and should have been stretched much wider than it was in the immediate post-war years. And that, of course, just as the Holocaust was unthinkable without the contribution of camp guards like Bruno Dye, ultimately it was also not really thinkable without the contribution of so many millions of Germans who voted Hitler into power, who looked away when their Jewish neighbors were taken away, and who fought loyally and until the very bitter end. So in that sense, yes, I do think that that generation of Germans has still some very interesting and damning questions to answer.
It doesn't seem, though, Tobias, to be news. I mean, everybody knows about German war guilt. In the writing and research for this book, and in terms of attending the day, die, I don't know how you pronounce it, trial in Hamburg, did you learn anything else that might be added on to the age-old debate, perhaps best represented by Arendt's banality of evil argument?
Well, I do think, I mean, my fascination, I think, was stoked by the personal experience of being in the trial. I mean, I was very conscious, I think everyone in this trial was very conscious, that this was for the key participants, i.e. the defendant, but also for the witnesses, the survivors of Stutthof, the last time they would tell their story and heard the story being told in a court of law. And I also think that, and this is genuinely new, that this is a class of culprit that was never really taken to court previously. I mean, this was there were hundreds of thousands of lower level perpetrators and participants in the Holocaust who never had to face their day in court. And again, I think Germany is rightly widely praised for the way it ultimately faced up to the crimes of the Nazis. But I think there is a huge blind spot here, and that is that arguably in the one arena where facing up to the past mattered the most, i.e. in a court of law, German justice failed abjectly until this very last gasp effort by prosecutors and judges to bring the last perpetrators of the Holocaust to court. But so I do think this was not a story that was so deeply familiar to me, to be quite honest, despite having grown up in Germany.
Isn't there something sadly ironic about that? I mean, Bruno Dey certainly wasn't a big fish. Tell me about him. How old was he when he was a guard? 17 years old?
Yes, so he started his duty at Stutthof when he was just 17 years old and then turned 18 while he was still there. He was really on the lowest rung of the ladder. He was a simple camp guard working 12-hour shifts, standing on the guard towers and also guarding the prisoners when they were out on sort of work duties. He was not a member of the Nazi Party. He clearly didn't identify very strongly with Nazi ideology. He was a very simple baker's apprentice who was drafted into this. One of the legally complex aspects of the case was that he was deemed unfit to fight on the front, which is why he was posted to the concentration camp in the first place. And so he really struggled throughout this trial with understanding what his contribution to the mass killings that took place was. He really, until almost the very end of the trial, did not acknowledge any personal guilt. He kept on saying, I didn't want this, I didn't do anything. So he never really understood his guard duty as being a meaningful contribution to what was happening in the gas chambers and in the barracks below. And after the war, he lived a very simple, unblemished life. He worked for a while as a truck driver. And of course, in some ways, he had the, if you like, the bad luck of living for so long that he was finally caught up in this last gasp attempt by German justice to bring these kind of perpetrators to court. But there's no doubt that he was certainly not a man of great evil. But in some ways, that's exactly what I found so fascinating about him and about this trial, because it sort of directed the view or directed the sort of obsession with the Holocaust away from these monstrous figures that we're all familiar with, the Rudolf Hesses and Himmlers and Hitlers and so forth, towards the contribution of the ordinary man. And I think in terms of learning from history, that's probably a more impactful and more intriguing example to examine.
Yeah, he was eventually convicted, I think, of 5,232 murders. And one of the striking things is he always seems to be covering his face. He's clearly has some guilt and doesn't want to be seen, even if he's in his 90s. So, Tobias, what does that tell us? I mean, from the way you're telling this story, here was a kid, a baker's apprentice, someone learning to be a baker to make bread. And in these days, in those years in Germany, it was hard not to get into the army. Clearly had some physical problems. He ended up in a camp. He obeyed the rules and became part of this mass murdering machine. What did it teach you about evil? And again, coming back to your grandfather, who was not just a card-carrying Nazi. I think he joined the party in 1933, but also had spent some time in the SS. Does that mean anyone? I mean, even your grandfather, and I use that word even carefully because, of course, he wasn't necessarily a typical German. That your grandfather, had he been given work in a camp at 17, would have done the same thing.
I mean, that is unfortunately impossible to answer, but I think
Well,
it's a
obviously,
question.
but uh, that
But
that's
we
given.
can, yeah. I mean, I think the more interesting question, or but if I may, is what would we have done? And I think this was the question everyone
Right.
in this trial asked themselves. And interestingly, in her verdict, even the presiding judge said, "No one, none of us can say that we would have behaved any differently," which is quite a striking admission to make by a criminal judge. By a criminal judge. Handing down a prison sentence to a 93-year-old man. I mean, I think ultimately this there's obviously a legal answer to this, which is quite simply, yes, by any legal standard, Born or Die made a contribution to the murder of these 5,230 people. And under German criminal law, there's no statute of limitations on murder. So yes, it was absolutely right that he was put on trial. And the verdict too, at least to me, seemed entirely justifiable. The interesting, or the more interesting bit of the verdict, other than the sort of guilty bit and the prison sentence, I thought was what the justice, what the presiding judge had to say precisely about the nature of evil. And her main takeaway from this was that great evil requires often not just the contribution of, sort of superior evil mind. It requires the collaboration of a lot of very ordinary people who, frankly, under no circumstance would be sort of deemed evil. They're very normal people who, in a different, had they been born at a different time and in a different place, would almost certainly not have become accomplices to murder. And I think it is something that is worth thinking about today and in any age, which is what is the responsibility of the individual in a criminal system, or indeed in a system that may sooner or later turn towards barbarity and criminality. And I think the I mean, I did interview most of the participants, including the presiding judge, some years after the verdict was handed down. And one of the interesting thoughts the judge left me with was that for someone like Dai, in the situation he was in, it was very difficult to turn around. And that really the way to the moment to stop this crime from taking place, obviously, was many, many years before that. And that the culpability, if you like, extends towards the behavior and the voting patterns and the lack of civil courage of millions of Germans in the early 30s leading up to 1939.
I was suggesting the whole German nation should have been on trial, which, of course, in a sense, it has been. And certainly the von Papens and other political figures who enabled Hitler. I mean, coming back to Day, Tobias, you note that he was an ordinary fellow, he obeyed orders. It required someone extraordinary not to kill these people, not to participate in the mass killing. I mean, it would have almost inevitably resulted in their death, wouldn't it? If they had recognized that what he was doing was obviously a crime against humanity and he simply wasn't going to do it, he would be signing his own death warrant, wouldn't he?
No, he wouldn't. I mean, this is, I think, a sort of convenient excuse that many sort of Nazi defendants and defendants accused of crimes around the Holocaust have tried to use, but it has been dispelled really since the 1960s. There is no known case of an SS officer or an SS man or someone in the concentration camp system refusing an order and being killed for it. There would have, of course, been repercussions, but one, and there were many, many sessions of this trial were devoted to precisely this question: did he have the ability to walk, to get down from his watchtower, hand over his gun, and say, "I can't do this anymore"? That was essentially one of the central questions of the trial, and many hours were devoted to this discussion with historians and such like. And the answer was really quite unequivocal. So there was no, there's no known case of someone of a German camp guard being executed or being sentenced to death for a refusal to obey an order. It was in fact quite common practice for those who had qualms to be removed quite quickly from these locations, because of course there were fears around the impact on the wider morale of the guard battalions. So of course it would have been difficult, and the alternative the real alternative that Dai and other people like him faced was to ultimately volunteer for the front. I mean, which would have been possible even though he had initially been told he was unfit for frontline duty. So yes, it was an incredibly difficult decision to make. And it is one that no one would envy that generation of Germans for. But what is the alternative? I mean, we can't, you know, a democratic state governed by the rule of law cannot say that it was okay to stay on the watchtower. It was okay to stop the desperate inmates of a concentration camp from fleeing their plight. So I really don't think there was, I think there was an alternative for him. It was a very, very difficult one to take, but realistically there was an alternative. And today there's no alternative other than to put these last surviving perpetrators on trial.
I want to take a break in a second, Tobias, but final question on this. Were there many examples of young men like Day who simply said, as you suggested, I can't do this, put me anywhere else, but I cannot participate in this mass murder of women and children?
There weren't many, but there were some. And I think this has been, I mean, this is a pattern, I think, that you see in quite a lot of the literature that looks at the sort of psychology of the perpetrators and so forth, which is that in some ways, I mean, there were very few enthusiastic murderers in these camps. I mean, there were, of course, absolutely sadistic brutes who operated there, but most of them were pretty ordinary people who probably had qualms about what was happening, who didn't like what was happening, but it was easier for them to either flee into, as one of the perpetrators said, into the comfort of obedience, you know, rather than face these difficult decisions and these difficult confrontations with their superior officers. It was easier to flee into the comfort of obedience, or they were simply succumbing to peer pressure. Again, I mean, this is one of the interesting, I think, takeaways from Browning's book about the police battalion 101, Ordinary Men, where, I mean, one of his conclusions is indeed that sort of peer pressure was a major factor. It was ultimately easier to shoot than it was to walk away from the group and confront the group.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've seen Jonathan Glazer's Zone of Interest, in which he even, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he seems to present Rudolf Höss, the commandant of Auschwitz, as someone, if not who was suffering from peer pressure, certainly someone who didn't get a lot of pleasure in what he was doing.
Yes, I mean, I think he's a very good case of someone who, as far as I know, was primarily motivated by a sense of career advancement. I mean, that was, of course, another major factor. I mean, there was a sense of, you know, you being in a concentration camp, as ghastly and horrible as it was, also for the for some of the people who were working there, clearly was a safer place to be than fighting on the front. It was something that could help advance your career if the Nazi state had survived. And then yes, there were all these sort of slightly peculiar and somewhat mundane sounding psychological factors, I think, that prevented Born or Die and tens, if not hundreds of thousands of men like him to not climb down from their watchtower.
Yeah, that could be I think I'm thinking, Tobias, for titling this, is it okay to stay on the watchtower? We are speaking with Tobias Bach, who has written a very important book, another book I know on the Holocaust, but that's the nature of things. Final Verdict, The Holocaust on Trial in the 21st Century. In some ways, it's more a book about the Holocaust on trial and perhaps not on trial in the 21st century. Take a short break, and then I want to talk about that 21st century. I want to remind everyone that this kind of high-quality conversation, at least high-quality guests, are brought to us because of our friends at Liberty, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, who do a very good job also writing about the moral complexities of not just the Holocaust, but of anti-Semitism over the ages. Going to run a short feature on liberties, and then we'll be back with Tobias Buck to talk about the Holocaust specifically in the 21st century. So don't go away, anyone.
The noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties, it's not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Tobias Buck, the managing editor of the Financial Times and the author of Final Verdict, The Holocaust on Trial in the 21st Century. Tobias, maybe I have a rather cynical view of this, but is there any truth that the further away we get from the Holocaust, the more obsessed we get with it? When I was growing up in the England of the 60s and 70s, I mean, obviously there was a great deal of interest amongst historians, but it hadn't permeated the broad culture. Now it seems as if it's almost impossible to have a conversation without Hitler popping up. Has something changed between the end of the Second World War and 2024 in terms of how we remember or perhaps don't remember the Holocaust?
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. That is somewhat, it is something that I find baffling and surprising when I look at not least the immense volume of books that are being published and the sort of string of books about the so-and-so of Auschwitz, the tailor of Auschwitz, the violinist of Auschwitz, and so forth. It's sort of there is something sort of almost the scale of the output is quite staggering. It is interesting, having reflected and written now about the way the Holocaust has been perceived and sort of has permeated Germany's collective conscience over the decades, from obviously a desire to forget as much as possible in the immediate post-war years, to then the beginning of thinking about the Holocaust, prosecuting the Holocaust in the 60s, to then a real spike in interest and a sort of obsessiveness with the Holocaust and what it means today, that I think was to a very large degree driven by popular culture. So one big inflection point in Germany was the release of the TV series Holocaust, I think in the very late 70s, early 80s. And then, of course, Schindler's List in the 90s. And so to some degree, the way that Germany thinks about the Holocaust has almost been sort of re-imported from the US. And which has also led to a very sort of victim-centric way of perceiving and thinking about the Holocaust, which of course is to some degree entirely justified. But it seems that sort of the way Germans often think about the Holocaust is by looking at it through the eyes of the victim. And while that is an entirely valid and important perspective, it is of course for Germans in particular also important to think about it from the vantage point of the perpetrator. And that perhaps in political terms is a more important vantage point to use.
Yeah, it's a rather odd situation, Tobias. As you say, the Holocaust hasn't, I won't say stolen or appropriated, but now is represented by, as you say, Schindler's List, and it's Steven Spielberg's version of the Holocaust. What's been the impact of that in Germany itself? You've written some interesting pieces on German memory, wrote an excellent piece earlier in March on the fight for Germany's memory culture. In an odd way, has the Holocaust, because of its Schindler's listification, has it been stolen from the Germans? Has it been universalized?
There is an aspect to that. I mean, this is. I mean, the way Germany thinks about the Holocaust is so complex and so profound. It's difficult to reduce it to one source or to one sort of strand of thinking. There certainly is that sort of strong Hollywood strand, but there's of course also a huge amount of very serious and subtle thought about what the Holocaust means today. And there is, of course, also, and that's sort of part of it, there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to this. There's, of course, also a never-ending and often quite sort of intense and angry debate about what the Holocaust means for Germany today, which takes place, obviously, under very different parameters than anywhere else in the world. I mean, the main lesson that Germany took away from this, and that is really ingrained at a political level, at a social level, but almost also at an individual level, is this sort of mandate of never again. Germany must never, that basically the sort of axiom of German politics is do whatever needs to be done to make sure that Auschwitz does not repeat itself. And that's, you know, obviously.
You mean in Germany or in the world?
In the world. But it obviously leads to very different, it can be quite a malleable imperative. So when you look at the discussion around the war in Ukraine, you had, you know, a school of thought in Germany that was, you know, very strongly opposed to taking an active role in this, for example, by supplying weapons to Ukraine. There's obviously a very strong pro-Russian strand of thinking in German society still. And then there was equally a very strong strand that said, you know, no, we cannot accept that a sort of dictator marches into a peaceful country, into Central Europe, and imposes its brutal regime there. And ultimately, both those positions, I think, were sort of had their origin in because of Hitler and the Holocaust, Germany must or must not. So it's sort of quite debatable how useful of a political maxim this is when it can be so used by both sides in an argument. Where German memory culture, I think, has become very unique is the degree to which it, as a, you know, permeates almost every aspect of German life. And there's a famous quote by a former German president that states that there's no German identity without Auschwitz. And I'm not sure that is an exaggeration. I mean, it is really that profoundly part of the idea of what it means to be German today. And from that, of course, also all sorts of problematic questions arise, such as what does the Holocaust mean in a country where one in four citizens actually does not trace their roots back to Germans in Bavaria or Berlin or the Rhineland, but came in the 50s, 60s, 70s or later from Turkey, from Italy, from Russia, from Iran, from Africa, from wherever. So how to preserve Germany's memory culture in a multicultural state and society is a real challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Ukraine. You didn't mention Gaza, which of course is even more complicated because some people believe that the perpetrators of this particular genocide are Jews, and it's one of the consequences of the Second World War. In your fight for German memory, Germany's memory culture, which is in some ways adapted from the book, you address the issue of the so-called far-right alternative for Germany. Some people call them neo-Nazis in Germany. When it comes to this fight for memory culture and the idea of Auschwitz being the core, the central place of German historical memory, what do the alternative for Germany people say? What's their take on Auschwitz?
Well, so I mean, German memory culture is under assault, as it possibly hasn't been for many decades, and obviously one line of attack, it comes from the far right, comes from the likes of the Alternative for Germany party. They are not Holocaust deniers, I have to be clear. They don't deny that 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis, but they want Germans to pay a little bit less attention to it. They would much rather that Germans celebrate sort of more glorious parts of their history and stop wallowing, as they would put it, in this culture of shame.
More Hegel and less Hitler, in other words.
Yes, I'm not sure Hegel is top of their.
I'm not sure if they would quite understand Hegel. What, Bismarck? Who do they really respect? Bismarck?
Yes, I mean, I suppose there would be elements of Germany's 19th century around the unification of Germany, the creation of the German Reich. I mean, it's all a bit silly, isn't it? I mean, the idea of celebrating any nation's history as purely glorious or purely victorious is frankly faintly ridiculous. So,
but that's how it's done in every country, for better or worse, Tobias. It always has been and probably always will be.
Yeah, well, not in Germany, and unless the AfD makes major electoral breakthroughs in the years to come, I doubt it'll be like that too. But I mean, it's perhaps not so much that they think of particularly impressive episodes of German history as such. It is more that they think that the indisputably atrocious bit of German history, the one between 33 and 45, garners too much attention. I mean, it also takes up a lot of physical space, if you like. If you think of the famous Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, which is right in the center of this of the city. And that, of course, is replicated in many, many German cities.
They want to pull the stones down, the AfD?
No, there's no proposal like that. But there are certainly the more extreme thinkers inside the AfD bemoan its existence. That's for sure.
You were in the piece. You talk about a broader history of Germany. You know, Germany has a history before 1933 as well of German colonialism. In your narrative for this book, and thinking about yourself as half German and your study of your grandfather and in this trial, is there anything special about German history, or is it in some ways little different from, you know, when it comes to colonialism and the various genocides in Africa? Is it little different from the history of England or France or Belgium or Russia or the United States?
Well, I mean, that goes to the heart of an exceptionally complex question, which
that's
is
why I asked
the singularity of the Holocaust, which of course is one of the big points of contention around German memory culture. This one perhaps not so much under attack from the German far right, but from the progressive camp, and the argument that indeed, just looking at Germany alone, are we giving sufficient attention to the crimes committed in German Southwest Africa in the early 20th century? But you could just as easily make the argument around other
India, many India. Places in America, the genocide against Native Americans that was a state project in the early 19th century. I mean, ultimately, Toby, Tobias, we're coming too familiar here. You go by Tobias, not Toby, right?
Maybe I'm fine either way.
I was thinking of our mutual friend, Toby Mundy. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, is all this, and it's been said many times before, I can't remember the cliched quote, but history is always the narrative of the victors. So had Germany won the war, would it this episode, the mass murder of the Jews, be glossed over in the way in which Americans have glossed over the murder of millions of Native Americans, or the British glossed over the various crimes in India and elsewhere?
I strongly doubt it, to be honest. I also don't think that, at least today, those crimes are being glossed over. I mean, there is obviously and rightly everywhere in the world growing pressure to commemorate these appalling crimes. But are they comparable with the Holocaust? I think perhaps this is the half German speaking, but to me, the Holocaust retains many singular aspects.
You're seizing it back from Steven Spielberg.
I think that the Holocaust has, I think, you know, going back to your very first question, one of the reasons why the Holocaust has such a hold on us and why so many authors and historians and writers and journalists keep returning to this theme and wanting to write about it, and plainly also finding an audience for their works, is because there is universal. There are still, I think, a lot of universal messages that can be extracted from it, and there's still a universal and perhaps a unique revulsion at what happened, and also a unique puzzlement at how this could happen and how a seemingly civilized country could descend to such levels of barbarity. And it is ultimately not the worst imperative for a country like Germany to follow, do whatever needs to be done so that Auschwitz does not repeat itself. So I do think the singular aspects that remain, the industrial nature, the use of all technical, administrative, bureaucratic, military levers at the disposal of a modern nation state to eliminate a population is, I think, still stands as a singular crime in world history. And certainly from a German perspective, it is the one that we need to think about and reflect upon more than any other.
We're obsessed with it, but again, in the age of the German Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Israelis in Gaza, it's a complicated thing. Final question, Tobias, this is an interesting subject, an important, obviously, subject. Day is in some ways, I mean, he's an old man, or wasn't. Is he still alive? Is he in prison now?
He is still alive. His sentence was suspended.
How old is he now? Is he 95, 96?
He would be 97.
Okay, so there aren't going to be many Nazi guards left. They're all going to die in prison or die in their beds somewhere or other in Argentina or Germany, wherever they happen to be. What about, and at some point they'll all be gone, what about books on the Holocaust? Do we need a final book on the final solution? It seems to me that the best books, the most memorable books, are the ones that suggest forgetting. I'm thinking in particular of Primo Levi. Either forgetting or laughing, like as a form of resistance, like the Polish author Tadeusz Borowski. What should a final book, if there was one, Tobias, on the Holocaust, what should it say or not say? And do we need now to learn to forget and move on?
I don't think forgetting is an option. I do think that the Holocaust and the years leading up to it and the way it has been processed and remembered both in Germany and around the world it's important that we remember and continue to draw the lesson from this. Now, this may sound a bit trite, but I don't really see the point of forgetting. I don't see the point of forgetting any historical episode. I don't see the point of not continuing to engage with one of the seminal, if not the seminal, historical crime. I do think that this is different from forgetting. I do think that Germany in particular has to ultimately move away from a memory culture that is that makes the Holocaust an integral part of what it means to be German. I think that is a sort of almost exclusionary way of drawing lessons from the Holocaust. And I think so Germany has to either formulate a more universalist approach to commemorating the Holocaust, or it must accept that different bits of the German population will remember the Holocaust differently. But that Germans and everyone should continue to think about the Holocaust, research the Holocaust, and write about the Holocaust is for me out of the question.